until very recently, the Commission has thought that was an important public interest objective for its rules. Where we are now, after the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and I'm glad you got an awful lot of background information on the creation of the Telecommunications Act from the Congressman Adler here, because what happened was there was this huge debate about the baby bells and how much power they'd be given over the telecommunications industry and how much competition could be provided from long-distance companies, et cetera. As the congressman said, at the 13th hour, a very effective lobbying campaign was created to add in some major deregulation of the broadcast industry, and particularly the elimination of any cap on national radio ownership. When you look at that, at the time, no company could own more than 40 AM radio stations and 40 FM radio stations. Now there is no limit on how many stations one company can own nationwide. As a result, we have one company, Clear Channel, which now has, according to most recent figures, 1,211 radio stations across the country. They're in almost every major market in America, and they have multiple stations in all of those markets. For African Americans, the radio rules are critical. Television is where the bulk of Americans get their news and information, and certainly African Americans get the bulk of their news and information there, too. We own too few of those stations to even have the ability to influence debate over television. We are left only with radio, and we only have 240 radio stations. So when the commission says it's a biennial review and everything's on the table, including radio ownership rules, we naturally get very concerned. Radio is the last bastion for African Americans to have any voice in the national debate of important issues. And it's critical to understand how ownership affects the national debate. Media companies of every stripe put news on the air. The question is, who decides what is news? Who's going to be the news director? Who's going to be the assignment editor? Who's going to decide what gets covered? Those things have to start at the top. It all starts from the top and goes down. And I see I didn't get a warning sign. Okay, I'm running out of time. But I want to say that the principal questions here are, who's going to decide who gets what news? Who's going to decide what programming gets on the air, whether it's public affairs or entertainment programming? Who is going to decide? If minorities are not making any of those decisions, the American public as a whole will lose out. Thank you.
Well, having four panelists to rush through the presentations, I do hope we have some questions. Margo, do you have some cards for me?
Final speaker was James Winston of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. In this forum, you're hearing live on media concentration and media ownership, live from Columbia University on Pacifica Radio. Robert Knight is at WBAI in New York. I'm Larry Bensky at KPFA in Berkeley, and we'll hear what the questions are from the audience for this panel.
Have any questions, go to it. See what we got here.
Pacifica.org on the Internet.
Well, how does or should the commission distinguish between diversity and variety in regards to media content? I guess that's the difference between ownership and, to say that, CBS owns Viacom owns the TNN and BET and CBS, is that enough variety? I mean, does that serve the purpose of diversity? If one company owns three very diverse types of networks with different kinds of programming. Richard?
Are we on here?
Yes.
Okay. I think, I don't know that we can directly answer that distinction. I think the more important question is, what is the objective standard for diversity? What's the objective standard for public interest? And based on the chairman's comments, on Chairman Powell's comments, how can those two most important issues be quantified in a way that the Chairman Powell would feel comfortable delivering, that correct metrics have been delivered for the court's sake. I don't grasp that at all, and this is probably improper, but if you wouldn't mind giving us some guidance on that, we could help. It would help us a lot to know how to address you, because I don't get that. I mean, what possible objective metrics can we give you about diversity, about public interest, other than opinion? That's all that can be stated. It's such subjective criterion, and you are the five people who have to make that decision. So this is an honest question, which you can either answer now or hopefully in the future. Is there some objective criterion you can give us that we could deliver you these metrics that you're looking for?
Anybody want to touch that?
You sound like my frustrated general counsel standing before a panel of judges. And I would urge that your frustration is the same one that I have had for 5 years. There's a certain amount of diversity that has historically been perceived as an act of faith. It has a sort of intuitive appeal, and at one point that was sort of sufficient within realm. I mean, we'd have some analysis that would support that. I think that the great legal frustration is that we have been told repeatedly, you can consider that we're 0 for 4 on the last media rule defenses in the court, that it's not enough to have that kind of visceral or opinionated or act of faith kind of presentation. It needs to have something else, some other grist. All I can say is that's what I think the most important part of this proceeding is about. We're trying to find that grist or that something else. It's one of the reasons we commissioned 12 empirical studies to see whether, when those hundreds of pages of data return, whether we begin to see patterns that we can articulate in slightly more objective ways to quantify or find the sweet spot. Because I don't think the court has told us the answer to that either. I think it's a trial and error thing. We will find what we can, and we'll go back to court, and we'll hope one day they say, the porridge is just right. But that's why I would emphasize that I don't think any of us know the answer to that. I can tell you, as an antitrust lawyer, I have thought long and hard. There's something called the HHI index used to measure concentration. We know how to do competition. And I've told every economist in my building, I will give an award to the first one who comes up with the HHI index for diversity. That there is a way to sort of take into consideration these things in a quantifiable way, produce a result. I wouldn't purport to try to explain that today, but I will tell you we have interesting work going on attempting to do something like that from the data sets that we have. I only hope that we're successful. So your frustration is my frustration. All I'm doing is, in a sense, appealing as partners that that's what we have to find, or certainly within a realm that the court will accept.
Would it be useful if the United States Congress were to clarify that for you?
You know, my view, there's a whole lot of things that would be useful, and I think Congress would clarify, because I think Commissioner Adelstein pointed it right. It's not disparaging to the public interest to say how unclear it is precisely what it means just from legislative guidance. It is a consequence of decades and years of rulings and re-rulings and court validations or invalidations. We're in a new realm in which the invalidations are far outweighing the validations, and we're in some ways back to square one about giving it meaning. Now, I take on that task. I mean, I think that we can do it. But I think as long as we stay focused on that precise mission and get that done, but I don't have the answer for you. I think that's exactly what this proceeding is meant to try to find.
It's Michael Pell, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, in discussion with Richard Mazur of the Screen Actors Guild.
It's sort of a good question.
Another question for the panel from the moderator.
The lack of FinCEN rules affect actors. Won't they get work regardless of who owns what and how much? And it's a good question, because you're worried about the four broadcast networks, and, you know, there's 50 networks out there now. Seems like there's a lot of work for SAG members.
Right. Let me just clarify.
Richard Mazur of SAG.
No one in doing the work that I do makes a dollar that somebody else doesn't make $10 off of. Okay, so let's just start with that. So, yes, there are a lot more potential jobs out there. There are a lot more outlets for programming. one of the problems is if all of these programming outlets were actually producing, we'd have a lot more jobs. They're not. They are recycling programming that comes from other parts of their corporate families, which was the point that I was trying to make. That's number one. Yes, of course, it's not particularly relevant to us in terms of how much available work there will be, whether or not corporate ownership of network ownership of 35 or 50 or 100% of the stations, the available reach is the case. That's not particularly relevant to us from one point of view. From the other point of view, as I made reference to, all of our collective bargaining agreements are based on initial compensation and residual compensation for the reuse of the product. And we have artificially suppressed the front end of that, in many cases because our employers have asked us to, in order to create a greater incentive and make it easier to produce original programming. However, the back end of that, which is to say the residual for reuse, has been a growing and increasingly more important issue for us, as it is for the Writers Guild of America, as it is for the Directors Guild of America and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. So when you have this in-house production then being dealt off to a corporate sibling at less than fair market value, which I maintain is the case because there has been no observable increase in the value of this programming on cable as the advertising revenues have risen in the various cable markets. There's been no observable increase. That is not a market. That is not a correctly operating market. I know this outside the FCC's purview. It's very much in the FTC's purview, and I believe that they need to take a look at this. So, yes, this consolidation of power directly impacts actors, writers, directors, singers, everyone who works on camera and behind the camera in this industry and participates in any kind of downstream revenue flow in exchange for their labor. And once again, I want to restate, nobody who works in front of the camera makes a dollar that somebody doesn't think they're going to make $10 off of, okay?
Sounds like America. If natural market forces, this is for Ellen, if natural market forces restrained only by the antitrust laws are allowed, what will be the impact on the presentation of alternative news views and creative outside the mainstream programming? Do you get it?
I guess what our theory is in terms of relying on antitrust theory is the antitrust laws define markets very narrowly. They define them as an economic market. So, for example, if there is, there's been a lot of talk about radio combinations, and my company's not in the radio business, so I'm not as familiar with that market. But before a radio combination can occur, the Justice Department is going to take a very hard look at the impact of that combination on economic competition in both the national and local market. But they will look only at other radio operators. They won't look at television, newspapers, and at cable, local cable advertising. They define the market very narrowly. If the antitrust laws allow the combination, you can be sure that the broader market of ideas will not be affected. In other words, when you start to take into account, as you're talking about diversity of viewpoints, you can't just look at radio. You're going to look at what's on television in that local market, how many newspapers there are, how many local magazines there are, and is there a local cable news channel. In other words, you should be looking at all potential local sources of information, and you, if it's commonly owned, if two are commonly owned, you only count it as one. You don't count them as multiple sources. But if the antitrust laws will kick in and prevent a combination long before there is any threat to diverse viewpoints. And I also believe that if the public is going to have so many choices now in terms of where it gets its news, broadcast, cable, internet, print, that if you don't have, you know, the business concerns and the marketplace will drive diversity of news, because if you don't present it, if you don't present people what they want, they'll have alternatives to turn to, and you just won't have, you just will be out of business.
It's Ellen Agress of Fox Television.
Here, real quick, I guess the question is this a result of concentration of ownership, BET, dumping its public affairs programming, and now that's owned by Viacom.
Yes, I wanted to respond. Before I answer that, I wanted to respond to Ellen's point. The whole problem, the whole reason why the FCC needs ownership rules is because there are unserved minorities that won't be served without regulation of the market. And competition is not a panacea for rules when it comes to certain unserved minorities. With respect to the Viacom purchase of BET, that, of course, is a very sad state of affairs for the African-American broadcast community. We only had one African-American-owned cable network, and that became zero when Viacom bought BET. It's needless to say how BET operates now that it's part of Viacom is a very closed matter. It's not open for public review. I can't tell you that it's because Viacom owns BET that BET just eliminated all its news and public affairs programming. However, when BET was African American owned, it had news and public affairs programming. So, you know, we can make some decisions about that based upon the facts before us.
I might also add that the marketplace is moving in there with Comcast. Is Alfred Liggins one of your members?
Yes, Alfred Liggins is the president of Radio One, which is the largest African-American-owned radio company. It's a publicly traded company. It's the only publicly traded African-American-owned radio company. And they announced this week a partnership with Comcast Cable to begin a cable channel targeted to African-American viewers, which would, of course, make it the second cable channel so targeted. What will happen as a result of that, what their programming will look like, what the channel will do, which consumers it will serve is much too early to tell. Hopefully they will bring another source. The cable industry is very troubling for an African-American viewer. There's one African-American channel that was expected to serve all African-Americans. And so there was always this public outcry in the African-American community because BET's principal fare was music videos. And my position has always been that if BET finds a business plan where music videos are the best way of making money, that's fine. The issue is not what BET does, the issue is that there was only one channel, and that's where the issue needs to be addressed, because we need more channels that are targeted.
Well, we don't know what it's going to be, but the point is that it is another new voice in that space. Join me in thanking the panel.
James Winston of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters on this live broadcast from Columbia University. While we have a moment in the changing panels here, I'm Larry Bensky in Berkeley with Robert Knight in New York. Robert, your thoughts on this issue that they've been tap-dancing around a little bit here in the last few minutes on diversity of ownership versus diversity of information. The Fox News representative saying, and Michael Powell saying, we basically need more studies, but basically the marketplace can take care of it. Others saying the marketplace isn't taking care of it, you need laws and regulations. That's one of the chief debates and discussions here. Robert? Knight, are you there? Apparently we've lost Robert Knight momentarily. Try to get him back. He is in New York co-hosting this broadcast on Pacifica Radio with me, Larry Bensky. I'm at KPFA in Berkeley, California. Robert, as soon as you're there, talk up and hope to hear from you. The panel is about to be seated. Will be about news and civic discourse. Juan Gonzalez of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and, of course, co-host of Democracy Now! Will be one of the panelists, as will Amy Mitchell of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Robert McChesney, whom we heard from at the opening of this broadcast a few hours ago, professor at the University of Illinois, and Dennis Swanson of Viacom Television Stations Group. This is about news and civic discourse, a subject that they began to touch on in the last panel. After this, in about an hour, there'll be an intermission for a lunch break, and we hope to have Robert Knight back by then. We'll be analyzing what went on in the morning session. We'll be bringing you the afternoon session as well, complete here on Pacifica. We'll also be opening our phones at that time, the toll-free nationwide number, so those of you out there following this, all or in part, can ask questions and make comments about what you've heard. This forum on media concentration and ownership is part of a discussion and debate about whether or not ownership regulations should further be relaxed from what they already have been relaxed into in the consolidation of ownership of radio and television stations in the United States, which has been consolidating increasingly over the past few years, and especially since 1996. We opened with four of the Federal Communications Commissioners, four out of five, having their say, including Michael Powell, the chair of the commission, who has stayed through these proceedings, and indeed you just heard him very recently talking back and forth with Richard Mazur of the Screen Actors Guild. In the afternoon panels, we'll be having a group of people from the entertainment industry, a group of community voices, including union members, and those representing a couple of African-American groups in New York City. Then a panel on business concerns with also a union representative involved in that. As one of the speakers earlier was alluding to, this will be followed next month in February by a full FCC meeting, real commission meeting in Richmond, Virginia. If you support this kind of broadcasting on Pacifica, we would urge you to log on right now to www.pacifica.org and make a secure personal pledge of money to keep us doing this kind of broadcasting. That's www.pacifica.org. Obviously, non-commercial broadcasting like Pacifica is the alternative, or one of the alternatives, to the kind of thing you're hearing described today. And we have no sure source of financial supply to do anything like this without your participation. www.pacifica.org. You'll see a flashing icon. It will lead you to a place where you can fill out some secure information and give us $50 or $100 or whatever it is you feel you can afford, tax deductible, to keep an alternative voice going. It should be significant to you that Pacifica is the only broadcast network that is troubling to bring you this forum on media ownership from Columbia University in New York City today. We're doing it because we believe it's extremely important. We're trying to revive Pacifica National Programming, which was a victim of our internal troubles over the past few years. Those internal troubles, by the way, were not foreign to, and we'll talk about this more during our lunch break, the media consolidation and the value of stations that we're talking about here, as two of our stations were threatened with sale by the board of directors that took over Pacifica directors for a couple of, Pacifica Radio for a couple of years. Extremely expensive transmitter properties here in Northern California and in New York. Might have been sold had we not defeated that board of directors and gotten back control of the network. That control means that we are once again listener-sponsored and dependent upon you, and so please do log on as soon as you can to www.pacifica.org. We'll go back to the New York proceedings now and the panel. The moderator is Harry Jessel, who is New York Editor-in-Chief of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. Also in our noon break, in about an hour, noon New York time, we'll be hearing from various people, including a representative of those who write things for television, Creative Community, and as well as a former FCC commissioner, Nicholas Johnson, the man who is legendary now for being a dissenter from the corporate takeover of media. We'll be talking with him live here on this Pacifica radio broadcast when we take our noon break. The Kernikan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts at Columbia University's Law School is what we've been listening to, or where we're listening to, and they're about to start again on the next panel.
Okay, we're going to go ahead with the second panel here. Our panelists are Juan Gonzalez, president of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and a columnist for the New York Daily News; Amy Mitchell, associate director of Project for Excellence in Journalism; Bob McChesney, professor of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and the author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy, and Dennis Swanson, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Viacom Television Station Group. Again, we'll start from right to left. Mr. Gonzalez?
Good morning. I'm Juan Gonzalez, President of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and represent more than 1,700 Latino media professionals in both print and the broadcast industry. I'm also a staff columnist for the New York Daily News and have been a professional journalist for 25 years. We'd like to thank Chairman Powell and the other commissioners for being here, and especially Commissioner Copps for continuing to advocate for the maximum possible public involvement and information on this issue. As people involved every day in producing news, my members have a unique perspective on the question before you. And as Latino journalists, we are painfully aware of the historical failings of our industry when it comes to serving the public interest and preserving diverse voices. A few weeks ago, the NEHJ released our 7th annual Network Brownout Report, which found that in 2001, less than 1% of all news stories on the network evening newscasts of ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN were about anything related to Latino issues. In the stories we reviewed, Latinos were too often stereotypically portrayed as illegal immigrants, as prone to violence, and as living in slums. This year, a study by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting found that 92% of all U.S. news sources who were interviewed on the nightly newscasts of ABC, CBS, and NBC in 2001 were white. It also found that of those 14,632 news sources quoted on the networks, 0.6% of them were Latino. So we're expert on nothing as far as the networks are concerned, but crime and immigration. A separate research done by the Wharton School professor Joel Wildfogel suggests that minorities are better served by minority-owned media outlets. One of the real issues confronting the commission that we're looking at is the planned merger of Univision and the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation radio network. If this merger is approved by both the Justice Department and the FCC, it will grant to Univision, and by the way, Univision is not a Hispanic-owned network, neither is the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation of 55 radio stations, will grant Univision 85% control of all Spanish-language media in the United States, both in radio and television. So the NEHJ is concerned about how lifting ownership caps will make it even harder to increase the little minority ownership that already exists among Hispanics in media. Furthermore, while our organization has not taken a final stand on each of the ownership restrictions you are reviewing, we are deeply troubled by the speed at which you are moving forward. You proposed in September to revamp a half dozen complex regulations for this before the spring, permanently altering the shape of the mass media in less time than it takes to complete an NBA basketball season. On January 2nd, we submitted to the FCC a long list of questions on how lifting caps would affect the news and information needs of 35 million Hispanic Americans. You see, for many of us, journalism is not just some consumer product like cornflakes or cars. At its best, it is a noble profession and a public service. It helps to right wrongs. It gives strength to the powerless. It informs and enlightens readers, viewers, and listeners about events outside their direct experience. But at its worst, journalism becomes the bait for the commercials. It distorts reality, inflames passions, reinforces stereotypes, marginalizes dissenting views, and functions as a mouthpiece for the powerful. No one is more aware than us how technology is fundamentally changing the way news and information is delivered, or how the rise of media conglomerates has radically altered the priorities of many news organizations. You've heard about Clear Channel, but the Washington Post quoted a Clear Channel executive who was running 26 stations in the Washington, D.C. area in a recent article. And the executive said, quote, "Every issue we discuss, every decision we make comes down to a simple test. Will it increase ratings or revenue? If it doesn't, let's move on. Now, Clear Channel is free to make all the money it wants, but as a broadcaster which gets a free license to use the public airwaves to serve the public interest, we ask, how can it do so when the company has virtually no news reporters, when even their disc jockeys are piping in the same playlist of songs to 20 or 40 stations from a different city? In closing, Supreme Court Justice Black declared back in 1945 in the Associated Press case that the First Amendment, quote, rests on the assumption that the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the public. We urge you to take seriously the criticisms of some of the nation's most prominent journalists and scholars who keep warning about the negative relationship between media consolidation and the quality and diversity of news. Nothing less than the future of democratic discourse and the role of a free press is at stake. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you.
Juan Gonzalez of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, columnist for the New York Daily News, co-host of Democracy Now!
Session. Amy Mitchell.
Amy Mitchell is Associate Director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism.
Thank you. Over the last 6 years, the Project for Excellence in Journalism has conducted a series of studies looking at the performance of the news media. These studies were designed to examine how journalism was impacted as a result of the changes in economics of the news business following the communications revolution. The findings of this research speak to some of the questions raised by Commissioner Cox as we're faced with another potential surge in consolidation and further change to the industry. There are four main points I'd like to make today. First, how the definition of news across different media have changed over the last 25 years. Second, how synergy works in network news. Third, five trends in local television news. And fourth, how journalists themselves feel about the changes that we can see. First, we examined how what constitutes news has changed over the last 25 years. In general, we found a decline in the seriousness of news and increases in lifestyle story and celebrity news. Our first study compared news content in the years of 1977, 87, and 97. The findings were evident across media, but particularly strong in network evening news. And that medium, what journalists consider traditional hard news, government, military, domestic, and foreign affairs, declined by more than a third. That decline coincided with increases in lifestyle and entertainment stories, which doubled. As of June 2001, the percent of traditional serious news was still less than half of the coverage. In the aftermath of September 11th, we saw serious news surge, but that surge was short-lived. By early 2002, those traditional hard news categories once again made up roughly half of the coverage. There was a short surge in hard news in early January of 2002 if we add in two traditionally not-so-serious subjects into the mix, but then it quickly declined once again. The evidence of our research suggests that this change is not unique to network news. We examined covers of weekly print news magazines and found that the percent of covers with political or international figures fell by more than 60% between 77 and 97. And instead, the covers were filled with celebrities. Newspapers have changed less in what they cover than the nightly network newscasts, but other sectors of the news media that might be considered growth areas, such as primetime magazines on the network shows, virtually ignore completely the traditional areas of news coverage. Moving beyond the definition of news, we have also studied the influence of corporate synergy. In the fall and summer of 2001, we examined the network morning news programs to quantify the extent of product promotion and company synergy. We found that excluding commercials and local TV news inserts, network morning news shows dedicated a third of their time to selling viewers something. That something could be a book, a movie, a garden gadget, whatever. If you add to that the 35 minutes of commercials per program, more than half of every two-hour show was spent selling something. The next logical question, then, is the extent to which this selling peddles products from the parent company versus other companies. According to the study, ownership clearly makes a difference. Each show did more stories about their own parent company products than any other single company. What makes these numbers even more startling is the amount of disclosure. Only 4 in 10 of these relationships were disclosed at all, and that was almost always when the case was promoting an upcoming program on that network. Perhaps no other medium is as much the focus of FCC ruling as local television. We conducted 5 years of research in what we think is the largest study by far of this medium. And what we found was a vast decline in enterprise reporting. Investigative reporting declined by 60%. The percent of stories with the correspondent at the scene declined by 30%. In contrast, the stories where we use purchase wire stories and syndicated material has more than doubled over the 5 years. And the percent of stories in which a camera is sent but no correspondent has doubled as well. We also have some information on surveys that we asked of news directors, which I'll just quickly mention, because I know my time is running short, but found that the half of the news directors say their budgets have been cut. When we asked about the overall health of the industry, half now see that the industry is moving in the wrong direction, compared to only 30% who see a positive, optimistic way of moving. Dissatisfaction with the industry is also evident among practitioners in general. We did another study where we worked with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, surveying the broad group of practitioners across media and across job levels, and found a strong sense that the bottom line pressures are hurting the quality of news. We also found that when it comes to buyouts of news organizations, 7 in 10 respondents see them as having a negative impact on the industry. So I'll say in closing that we're doing some additional research. I will submit all these as well as copies of the studies for the record and hope that you'll look at them further. We're doing some additional research that will be ready at the FCC hearing in Richmond. And in sum, we find in a variety of different media and a range of research instruments a sizable shift away from traditional hard news toward lighter, softer news, an emphasis towards product placement and network news content, a growing demand to produce more with less, and a sense of corporate influence on news content. Thank you.
Amy Mitchell of the Project for Excellence in Journalism on this Pacifica Radio broadcast live from Columbia University on media ownership. This is Robert McChesney of the University of Illinois.
I have the privilege of coming later, so a lot of what I wanted to say has already been said. But being a professor, that won't stop me. First of all, I'd like to echo the point that Congressman Nadler made, which I think is absolutely crucial, which is that the provisions about deregulating or loosening media ownership that are called for, at least the review that's called for in the 1996 Telecommunications Act, was not the result of an informed, feisty debate within Congress, even within the committees. It was an afterthought, to be generous. I've spoken to members of the relevant committee in the House who didn't even know the radio material deregulation was in the bill itself that they voted on, their own committee sent through. I think a significant percentage of members of Congress had no idea what was going on. Now, I can understand that the courts might say, well, that's irrelevant. The Congress passed it. How they passed it is not our business. They passed it. But I would say that the FCC is held to a different standard. The statute also calls for it to respond and reflect and represent the public interest, the same legislation that calls for the biennial review. Likewise, as Mr. Edelstein pointed out, the Red Line decision, another Supreme Court decision, makes it quite clear that the FCC has clear obligations with regard to the public interest that are every bit as paramount as the most recent decision regarding deregulation. I think that what Mr. Powell spoke about, to his great credit, and I think it's absolutely true, is that there are tremendous claims about deregulation, the benefits of them that need to be examined. We have to have hard evidence. We need to look at them. And I think the preliminary record we see with radio is unequivocal on this point, at least the initial look at radio. As Mr. Copps and Mr. Nadler have both spoken about, the deregulation or the loosening of radio ownership, and deregulation I think is a very misleading term because what you really have with deregulation is you still have significant regulation. I mean, you can't broadcast on Clear Channel or Viacom's frequencies. There's heavy regulation. But deregulation really means just regulation purely for private interest, any pretense of regulating for the public. It's still heavily regulated. It's not deregulated. It's not free market. No one can go onto their frequencies. You go to jail if you go on their frequencies. But the claims for deregulation need to be studied and studied closely. With regard to radio, I think the evidence is coming in that the massive consolidation of ownership, while it may well have been a boon of tremendous value to the shareholders in the largest companies or to some of the people who have sold out their stations, has been anything but positive for listeners, for journalists, for communities. The decline in local journalism and localism, the increase in advertising and commercialism in the airways, These are the comments I receive constantly. This is what I see when I speak around the country. I think if the commission were to travel around the country and talk to people, this is what they would be inundated with, comments to this effect. I would argue that what the commission needs to perhaps consider is a very serious, hard examination that goes far beyond what's presently proposed. I recall how Canada, when it first considered how to develop radio and television, its equivalent of the FCC at that time, held public hearings in the 27 largest cities in Canada. The 27, you get number 27 in Canada, you're down to like Moose Jaw. And then they compiled public hearings in all 27 communities, then went to the Canadian Parliament with a report and said, this is what we found, now you debate it and come up with policies. This is too important for us three people, the Erie Commission, to make these decisions on our own. But that's, I would argue, democratic policymaking. I'd also argue that the idea that we can find quantitative evidence for everything is misleading. I love quantitative evidence. I use it in my research. But some things you can't just find scientific quantitative evidence for. It's just not possible. That doesn't mean you can't find an explanation. Read great history books. They use some quantitative evidence, but you can't do purely quantitative analysis of the Civil War or the American Revolution or Christianity. Some things can't be put down into an equation. And just because you can't doesn't mean it can't be proven. We have real studies, so I'll close with just a few of the issues that demand very detailed, rigorous study before any deregulation should be done. First, journalism. As Ms. Mitchell talked about, there's a real crisis in journalism. Increasingly, there's evidence that what's good for these companies, what makes the most money, does not produce the best journalism. If we allow companies to conglomerate, known television, radio, cable companies within a community, there's a real concern you'll have one newsroom in these communities. And the real concern, there'll be a real lack of localism in these communities, lack of local journalism. Already a crisis, but it'll just get that much worse. There'll be much less coverage, if that's possible, of candidates and elections in our free media. Reduction where candidates basically get into bidding wars on political advertising. Also, this concentration, we have to examine how much it will accelerate the hyper-commercialism, which is evident across our media culture. The increase in the total amount of advertising, but even more ominously, the increase in the deterioration of the border between advertising and the editorial or creative part of our media. That's a real issue, especially with children, but in our journalism and across our culture. This has to be studied. We have to expect what will happen with conglomeration and concentration if we don't examine these issues. And then finally, my last point is the Internet. Invariably, the arguments for deregulation come down to the point that the Internet changes everything. It sets us free. It introduces thousands and thousands of voices. We need real examination of exactly how the Internet's going to work this magical way. So far, there have been no commercially successful content providers generated by the Internet after 10 years. So it hasn't been provided a commercial alternative yet. To the extent it's been commercial, it's been incorporated by the largest companies. Likewise, to the extent the Internet does develop commercially, there's no evidence that it develops locally. And since so many of these deregulations will affect local communities and local markets, lead to concentration there, there's no reason to expect the Internet will solve that problem for us. I'd submit these are questions that need to be examined, and no credible public service can be done until it gets serious, slow, detailed examination and debate. Thank you.
Robert McChesney, professor at the University of Illinois, author of Rich Media, Poor Democracy. You're on this Pacifica Radio live broadcast from New York on media ownership. The final panelist in this panel is Dennis Swanson of Viacom Television.
Just an observation before I start. At the Viacom Television Stations Group, we strive for fairness, accuracy, and balance in our news presentations. It appears it wasn't the criterion putting together this panel, but I'll do my best to offer some contrary views. I am the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Viacom Television Stations Group. In my 40-plus years in this business, I've worked for Tribune Broadcasting in Chicago, NBC News when the company was owned by RCA, ABC when it was owned by ABC, when it was owned by Cap Cities ABC, and when it was owned by Disney. Then NBC when it was owned by GE and still is. And most recently, my present position with Viacom. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some insights into the way network-owned and operated groups in general and Viacom stations in particular have made great contributions to the Commission's goals of competition, localism, and diversity in numerous television markets across the United States. Viacom owns and operates 39 television stations, 20 CBS, 18 UPN, and one independent. They're in markets both large and small, from the nation's biggest designated market, New York, to the 69th ranked DMA, Green Bay, Wisconsin. We also operate duopolies in 8 markets. Throughout our markets, Viacom has a proven record of commitment to local news and information programming. We are extremely proud of the leading role our stations have taken in providing their communities with content targeted towards the needs and interests of local citizens. Nowhere has this been more evident or obvious than in our commitment to local newscasts. In fact, Viacom's 2 stations in Los Angeles together produce 61.5 hours of regularly scheduled local news each week, the most of any duopoly in the country. In Philadelphia, Viacom added 15 hours of local news per week since creating a duopoly. We've also increased the total amount of local news in Pittsburgh by 8.5 hours a week since forming a duopoly. In both markets, Viacom stations air more than 37 hours of regularly scheduled local news each week. Viacom has launched new 10 p.m. newscasts in one of the stations in our Miami duopoly, while in both Boston and San Francisco, we've expanded our news output by 3.5 hours per week since the formation of duopolies. The numbers tell a similar story in many of our non-duopoly markets, such as Minneapolis, Baltimore, and Austin, where Viacom has increased the total amount of local news in recent years. We did reduce our local news in Detroit recently, mainly because of the affiliate switch a decade ago. We've really never been able to overcome our circumstances there. However, CBS News remains on WWJ-TV 7 days a week, and we've added local news on WKBD-TV. It's produced by Scripps Howard. We're also extremely proud of the quality of Viacom's news programming and of our broadcast journalists, producers, and news directors who've achieved such a high measure of success in recent years. As part of the comments Viacom submitted to the biennial review proceeding, we included a detailed chart listing page after page of the numerous awards our stations have won in the past 2 years alone. The most fundamental element of Viacom's commitment to its communities is that of local programming, and that it's truly local. In view of the substantial efficiencies generated by group ownership, the vast majority of television stations in the United States, both network-owned and affiliates, are licensed to group owners who are headquartered in, at most, only one of the markets in which they own a television station. As a result, group owners must put in place and rely upon local managers who are attuned to the needs and interests of the local viewers. Viacom takes this relationship very seriously. As Mel Karmazan, our President Chief Operating Officer, has told the Congress, it's vital that television stations determine locally how much news to air, what stories are run, and when they are aired. Our station's news directors have complete freedom locally. This is a fundamental CBS policy. And it is good business. I've actually always been puzzled when people argue that my group of network-owned stations is somehow less attuned to the local taste in the East just because we're headquartered in New York. There's no reason to believe that network-owned station groups are less capable of sensitivity to local needs than our affiliate station groups based, say, in Atlanta. Indeed, Viacom knows that it is critically important for local managers who have the closest links to the local community, and they're to be given discretion to ensure that their stations are meeting the needs of viewers in these communities. We recognize that our bedrock commitment to local viewers starts with truly local content. At Viacom, we feel strongly that each of our local communities needs to be treated individually. That is why we hire capable local managers and trust them to ensure that their stations provide the types of programming best suited to their viewers' needs and tastes. It's been suggested to the FCC that network-owned stations have less inclination and willingness to preempt the network programming than independently owned affiliates. The facts, however, simply do not bear this out. To the contrary, the presence of attentive local managers with local discretion has resulted in network-owned stations developing a record preempting the network programming feed that is substantially similar to the preemption record of independently owned affiliates. To the degree that there is any difference between the network-owned and affiliate station preemptions, it's largely due to the higher preemption rate by affiliates for paid programming and telethons. By contrast, network-owned stations, including Viacom's, preempt more often than affiliates for both news and sports programming. Just this past weekend in Pittsburgh, we added our own pregame Steelers Titans show preempting a CBS sports program and added an elongated post-game show that necessitated preempting CBS TV in prime time. Rather than focus on preemptions that are simply designed to benefit the bottom line, Viacom gives its managers the ability and responsibility to preempt the network feed for local programming that is actually of greater interest and importance to local viewers. In any event, it's worth pointing out that both network-owned stations and affiliates preempt actually less than 1% of primetime programming each year. In light of all this, there can be little doubt that network-owned stations have taken a leading role in committing to local news and information programming in local communities. If you don't have to take our word for it, empirical studies conducted by both the FCC's Media Ownership Working Group and by the renowned economist Dr. Bruce Owen clearly confirmed statistically that everything I've told you informally. In particular, the FCC's study number 7, the measurement of local television news and public affairs programs, concluded that network-owned stations outperform affiliates when it comes to local news programming. To summarize, I'd just like to reiterate how seriously Viacom takes its obligation to provide local programming with all of its communities in which we own television stations. Viacom's dedication to local programming has produced tangible results. We are proud that our stations are adding local news in so many communities and that our professionals are being recognized for their journalistic excellence. Viacom, together with the other major networks, recognizes the crucial role that local stations play in every community across the country, and we remain steadfastly committed to responsible corporate citizenship in all our markets. I do not find it at all surprising that the empirical data shows that network-owned stations provide more local news and information programming than for the affiliates. That's why we have urged the elimination of outmoded regulations like the National Television Ownership Cap, which prevents Viacom from bringing the benefits of its superior commitment to local news to additional markets. Thank you very much.
Dennis Swanson, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Viacom Television.
Okay, we do have some good questions here, and if I don't, you know, too many to handle in the next 20 minutes, don't be in the future panels, don't be discouraged. Keep them coming, and we'll try to get some flavor. A lot of them tend to hit the same themes, and we'll try to get to each of those themes. Mr. Gonzalez, how do you address the argument of El Negras that the increased diversity of outlets like the Internet and more magazines have added to the voices in the media? Don't other media, non-electronic media, don't they count?
Well, yes, non-electronic media count, but the reality is that, number one, when it comes to the Internet, I think most of the studies have shown that most Americans still depend on their main sources of information for television and newspapers, and while they are increasingly going on the Internet, it is not their dependable source of information. I think that really, as a print journalist, I recognize that television has become the dominant form of most people getting their news, but newspapers remain the fountainhead of information upon which even television and radio depend, and of which, of course, is why the owners are so interested in television stations and newspapers being able to increase their synergy and convergence by owning each other. But I think that the real problem, and you know, and I respect Dennis tremendously. He's one of the best television executives that I know. But I think that when he talks about how television is increasing the amount of time that they spend on news, there's forming this context. I would advise everybody who hasn't read Leonard Downey's book, The News About the News, American Journalism in Peril, he's no flamethrower, Washington Post editor, dissects how local news operates. And the reality is, as he notes in a Columbia University Project for Excellence study, in 1999, of 590 local newscasts on 59 stations across the country, found that 9 of every 10 local stories on these newscasts came either from the police scanner or scheduled events. the vast majority of events that are occurring in our local communities, television does not cover because there are not enough reporters at these stations to properly cover the communities.
Does that have to do with media concentration? Is that just sheer economics, a company trying to operate as leanly as it possibly can?
Well, I think it does have to do with media concentration. I believe that that the reality is that for the media managers, economies of scale in their ownership and their abilities to sell nationally and in national buys to advertisers, the profit margins in local television are astronomical. Owning a television station in America today is like owning a gold mine. You can't lose money. So the question is then, why are they not investing enough in this part of the public interest in exchange for their free license from the American people?
Dennis, you've got to respond to that.
Well, first of all, the network television business is a no-margin business. It's become a terribly difficult business because advertising revenues have been distributed across way more outlets, and at the same time, programming costs have escalated considerably. So there's virtually no margin. In fact, several of the networks, I think, probably at this point in time are losing money. And the profitability now is in the local stations, because they get two-thirds of the programming from the networks. And so that's why we would like to own more of our distribution system to help offset the lack of ability to generate revenues or profit out of the network side of things.
Well, let's stick on this point, because the next question is for Amy. I think Bob could address this, too. Is the problem with the quality of news coverage due to the lack of competition or the surplus of it? Maybe there's just too many news organizations to allow anyone to have those enterprise reporters out.
What we find in our study certainly is that the problem is within a news organization itself that's trying to maintain forms of profitability. And as we talk about, you know, adding more and more hours of news, you know, the growth industry in these on news stations now is adding more hours of news and news-type programming like primetime magazines and other talk programs, because they're much more economically feasible for organizations to do. They don't cost as much. You don't need new sets. You don't need new personnel to do these. And what we're finding, what we find in our survey of news directors, is that more and more they're saying, yes, we are producing more, but we're being asked to produce more with less staff. Now we see in our latest round of data that reporters, local correspondents, are producing an average of 2 stories per day, which is the highest ever they've been asked to produce. So certainly it doesn't seem that that's coming from having too much competition. It's the economics operating within a news organization itself.
Well, but make the connection to what the FCC is looking at. How is keeping the cap on the national ownership cap or the duopoly continuing to bar two station ownership in a market, how is that going to improve news? Why should they care? Why should these people care?
Well, it's not what happens if you don't bar it. Is what we're seeing happen is as enterprise reporting is declining, that's having less staff, less time to go do a story, we're getting more and more network fees, more and more wire services coming from fees, so that if the network, we have a large owner over more and more local news programs, especially in duopolies, et cetera, they're... Better? Sorry. They're going. What's going to happen if they're going to if a network continues to own more and more at the local level, those range of local stations are going to be putting out the same news because they're all getting it from wire feeds. You're getting more and more from wire feeds and syndicated material rather than doing their own reporting.
Well, I'll play the broadcaster's advocate. They say that owning two stations in the market will improve news because, you know, a lot of the second or third station in a market is really struggling right now. They can't afford to do news. And if they don't come in, if they don't allow dual ownership of stations, some of those third or fourth stations in a market are going to go dark. That can't be a good result.
But what's happening if they get taken over is not a good result either. In fact, I would argue that what we're